Good morning. We'd like to call the House Committee on Transportation. We have a couple of work sessions scheduled in the public hearing, but the first thing we're going to do is start with the public hearings on our uninvited testimony bills. And we have about seven or eight of them here. We'll pass those in. First of all, we'd like to open the public hearing on House Joint Resolution Number 1. Janet, could you give us a couple one-liners on that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Joint Resolution 1 would amend the Oregon Constitution to allow fuel taxes and other fees on motor vehicles to be used for state police and for public transportation to fill as filed at the request of the governor. And it would not would be at the next general election a vote on the resolution.
Thank you. Any discussion from the committee? We'll close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 1. Open the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 59. Janet, could you bring that to our attention?
House Joint Resolution 59, if sponsored by Representative Gianella, would amend the Constitution to allow funding for Oregon State Police from funds raised by fuel taxes and other taxes on motor vehicles. This vote would be require a vote of the people at the next regular general election.
Thank you. Any discussion from the committee? Hearing none, we'll close the hearing on House Joint Resolution 59. House will open public hearing on House Bill 2777.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2777, sponsored by Representative Patridge, would increase registration fees if a proposed amendment to the Constitution is adopted and allow those fees to be used for state police.
Thank you. Any discussion from the committee? Hearing none, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2777. Open the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 24.
Mr. Chair, the resolution sponsored by Representative Krupp and Senator Shannon would change the name of the Sunset Tunnel.
Thank you. Any discussion from the committee? A little later, I'm sure, Representative. Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 24. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3090.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3090, sponsored by Representative Beeman, would prohibit the Department of Transportation from starting construction on a limited access state highway unless the highway can pay for itself through tolls.
Thank you. Any discussion from the committee? Hearing none, close the hearing on House Bill 3090. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3511.
Mr. Chair, this bill, sponsored by Representative Lehman at the request of the Oregon Environmental Council, would repeal the dedication of specified monies for highway modernization.
Thank you. Any discussion in the committee? Hearing none. We close the public hearing on 3511. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2656.
Mr. Chair, this bill, also sponsored by Representative Lehman, would require at least 3% of state highway fund monies to be used exclusively for emergency repair and maintenance of highways.
Thank you, Janet. No discussion. Close the hearing on 2656. Close the public hearing on 2644.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2644 would require the Department of Transportation to co-sign that all urban growth boundaries on state highways.
Thank you. No discussion. Close the public hearing on 2644. Close the public hearing on 3156.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3156, at the request of Representative Backlund, would require proof of school attendance to maintain a driver's license, for issuance of a driver's license.
Thank you. No discussion. Close the hearing on 3156. Open the hearing on House Bill 2359.
Mr. House Bill 2359 would require the paying of parking fees before you can renew a driver's license.
Thank you. No discussion. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2359. Open the hearing on House Bill 2928.
House Bill 2928 would allow cities to impose additional registration fees on vehicles.
Thank you. No discussion. Close the public hearing on 2928. Open the public hearing on 2569.
House Bill 2569 would require passenger vehicles to carry litter bags.
Thank you. No discussion. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2569. We just gave life to 12 more bills for one more week. Next item on the agenda is we have not a quorum yet. So, can we just...
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
You're not going to do that much.
I
There we go.
Too much paperwork.
Do you read all that?
Yeah, no. Later, huh?
No, I do. I got it prepared.
We'll open the work session on House Bill 3294. Janet, could you explain what we're going to do to this bill, please?
Mr. Chair, the purpose of having a work session without a hearing is just for the purpose of considering a recommendation to refer this bill to the House Agriculture and Forestry Committee. The bill would require, House Bill 394 would require parachuting and skydiving facilities to obtain a license from the Department of Transportation, and would also require for those facilities to designate a drop zone of a certain size and either have that land owned by the parachute or skydiving facility or be under agreement with that facility that that area can be used by their patrons.
Thank you. I have spoken to the Speaker's office and to the gracious chairman of the Agriculture and Forestry Committee, who has a smile on his face and has agreed to take the bill. The chair would move House Bill 3294 to the Agricultural Forestry Committee.
Mr. Chairman, what does the chair of that committee know anything about skydiving and parachuting?
He knows a lot about that. He's going to learn a lot more. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, is there any opposition? No opposition. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the bill is on your way.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah. Now we get down to some other stuff we need to do. We'll open the work session, House Bill 2440. We'd like to spend about 15 or 20 minutes on that, and then we'll go into the continuation of the public hearing on 3344. 2440, Janet, could you bring us up to date on that? I believe we have some potential amendments to that bill, too. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2440 was the graduated driver license bill for 16 and 17. And what you have in your place this morning are the 2440-2 amendments. These partially came out of discussion of the committee last meeting, and they partially came from Representative Montgomery. You also have 2440-1 amendments at the request of Representative Hill. We have the -2 amendments that's been hand engrossed into your into the bill. And you also have at your place a summary that looks like this. It says the desk amendments at the top, the summary of what the desk amendments do. And Representative Edwards is here, has additional amendments to desk 2 and the desk 4 amendments.
The best 2 amendments are what we discussed in committee. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hill.
Mr. Chair, I'm just curious. Do you want me to make my futile effort now or later?
Well said.
Is it just on the word futile?
Oh, boy, yeah. Later would be better.
Okay, thank you.
We'll start with the -2 amendments, and Janet, is that how we'd like to start? And would you like to go through them with us, or
would
you like to have any questions about them?
The -2 amendments, the first thing they do is delete all of the stay in school provisions that were in the original bill, and that was discussed at the meeting we already had this week, or last Friday. And that's what most of the crossing out in the bill is. What you'll see on the first page of the hand growth bill that all of Section 1 is crossed out, but it is repeated with some changes on the second page. So we're not deleting those provisions, but they are being changed, and I'll explain some of that. The second change in the -2 amendments is that it exempts 16 or 17-year-olds from that are surrendering their licenses from another state from the new requirements, and those requirements are the driver training requirements, the 6 months having to have an instruction permit for 6 months, and the 25 hours of supervised driving in the bill. Again, if you're 16 or 17-year-old that's coming in from another state and you have a valid driver's license in that state, you would not be subject to the those provisions of the state license. Is that clear to people? Okay, that another change in that section is to increase the supervised driving time. This is not the driver's training, but the supervised driving time with a parent or another adult from 25 to 50 hours. The next change would be to keep the driver training requirement, but provide an exception to that requirement if you have additional supervised driving time. That's a new concept that was discussed a little bit on Friday. The idea is for areas that where someone is not able to obtain driver training either easily or at all. The amendment says 200 hours of supervised driving time. There was some discussion with Senator Crow's office of having it be 100 hours, but that's up to the committee.
Yeah, I would totally concur with the 100 hours. That's 8 days at the car. If they can't have 200 hours, is too long in my personal opinion. So if the committee would go along with the 100 hours, I think you have more opportunity to get a suitability. I don't want to see it die just because of $100.
Whatever, pick a number. It's pretty hard to know what number to pick.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's correct. We can work on it again next session. So if the committee is okay with the 100 hours.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, is that inclusive of the 50 or is that total?
The way the amendment is written, it would be inclusive, so you wouldn't have to add the 100 hours would be total. It wouldn't be 150.
Okay.
You mean that that fees are going to explain them all and then go through them?
Okay.
Representative Wilford.
Mr. Chair, I'm just questioning in terms of the wisdom of Section 8. In terms of where it makes the application of these changes on and or after the effective date. The effective date is going to be March 1st, so if I go in on February 29th and get my driver's license and I'm 16, I can drive with abandon. But if you go in on the 1st, you've got these restrictions. In terms of, and we've discussed that driving is not a right, it's a privilege. Why don't we just simply apply these to all provisional driver's licenses? Is there a legal reason why we wouldn't do that versus making this arbitrary change in terms of sense? So that, I mean, sort of the equal protection, you're both 16, your difference of one day versus, you know, and one 16-year-old would be able to drive with anyone in the car at any time, and another one would not.
No matter what day you pick, the same scenario could be.
Mr. Chair, my point is that if you don't make it effective on or after, in terms of the way this is written, is that if you get your driver's license, you have the restriction, rather than just being the fact that you're 16. That's what I'm arguing, is if you just apply it so that when it goes into effect, if you're 16, you'll fall into the, you know, you may have 3 days left of a restriction after, based upon the way this is written, if you don't have that application.
So I don't want to make it easier for them.
I'm making it harder.
Okay, that's good, but I like to make it harder.
Okay.
But if you want to put that in some language for it, that's
fine. I think effectively we just remove Section 8, which is the, so it would just go into effect on March 8th, or March 1st, and if you're 16 and a half and have your license for 6 months, you'd still have the last 6 months of restrictions in effect. Would that be a correct statement?
Okay with the committee?
I don't think we want to make this retroactive. Mr. Chair, retroactive, do we? Mm-hmm. The people who already have their probation.
No, if you have your license, you have your license.
That's what we're talking about.
That's what I'm talking about.
No. I think if they have their license, my personal opinion is they have their license.
But if you're 16 and you get your driver's license on February 29th, you will have no restrictions.
That's right.
And what's the difference between March 1st?
What's the difference?
I mean, you have 7th. Well, the difference is the fact that you still have two 16-year-olds. One would be able to drive with anybody in the car. They'll be able to drive between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. and, you know, in terms of the gift of the goose, gift of the gander. And that's why I came to this. If you don't do that, and we just pass this without that section, on March 1st, all 16-year-olds will have the exact same restrictions placed upon the provisional driver's license.
So it is excluding. I think, Mr. Chair, when you start looking at the timelines that are built in here, you have to be 6 months. You have to have the other six. This is what we have here. We have for the first 6 months and the second 6 months. I think you're going to run into problems with timelines if you try to apply it to a provisional license goes until you're age 18.
Yeah.
I think it's going to confuse the thing if you don't just set a date and anyone who gets their license after a certain date. So I think it's cleaner in my mind until I can be convinced otherwise. It's just going to set a date like it has in here.
Well, I mean, in terms of the person who's 16, it would all fall upon when they got their license. So in terms of if they get a provisional license on the 29th, they would then follow the restriction from March 1st on. In terms of, and so they would, and if you had your license for 6 months, you would have escaped the first 6 months of the restrictions based upon the time when you got your license, but you would have to follow the last 6 months of the restrictions on the license. And otherwise, we're going to have, you know, for 2 years, one class of 16-year-olds who it's okay for them, you know, to go off and be reckless, but another class, it isn't.
Mr. Chair, we already have, you know, we have that situation. We're going to have to start this. But I think if we're going to have the first 6 months and the second 6 months, and all these timelines in here, I don't think you can apply it retroactively, because it can apply to a person who gets his license the last day of 16, too.
No, I understand that, but I'm just saying in terms of those who already have their driver's licenses, why would we not put a driving time restriction on them if they got, just because they got their license on the 29th of February versus the 1st of March,
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, I think that's the way a lot of laws work. When they go into effect, they go into effect.
But we're exempting one whole class of 16-year-olds versus another class of 16-year-olds. That's not...
Well, they don't pass the bill. We're exempting all of them, so it's just one way or the other.
Mr. Chair, I see what Representative Hill is trying to get at, and maybe we could just not address the six-month requirements, but make it make the bill... work against all 16-year-olds for the driving time. He's talking about the midnight to 5 a.m. Is that only going to apply to those who turn 16 after the implementation date? And the way the bill reads, it is. So I think that driving time, if that applies to all 16 and 17-year-olds, regardless of when they got their license.
It's Section 3. Section 3 of the bill would not apply to a 16-year-old who received their license on February 29th, year 2000. But it would apply to a 16-year-old who gets their license after March 1st, the way the bill's written.
Are you and Janet, do you have some comments on this? We're going to work on this 10 more minutes on the dump. Go ahead, Janet.
Mr. Chair, the Section 8 also is a new requirement for obtaining a license, so you don't want to eliminate all of Section 8.
Go ahead. Come on up and join us.
And
thank you.
I'm not sure if law enforcement would have any question or problem with what works at EMD. I don't think it affects EMD, but law enforcement may have an opinion about the enforcement of the retroactive.
It would be easier enforcement after the fact. It would apply to everybody.
Right. Anyway.
Mr. Chair, I tend to concur with Representative Hill that I think from an enforcement point of view, setting up two classes of drivers under where the date's written, I understand the point. You got to start it at some point, and the EMD could tell you about why they need administratively to set a date. But I think law enforcement is going to have a problem with distinguishing, you know, one 16-year-old is going to have a birthday before that date and one after. And it seems like it should be retroactive. Just as a class, and everybody knows the 16 restrictions are applying. If they're 17, then we're good.
Mr. Chair, thank you. One additional thing is that when a person receives a provisional license, they're told what they can and can't do under the license, and
would be one question of getting the word out to people who already have their license, but that would be one additional consideration.
So that would be the same argument we could make for any lobby pass out of here. People don't know what we do. Governor Francis goes into effect. Yet your obligation is to follow the law. I'm sure it'll get out.
It is.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand the concerns for being expressed, but I think for an average police officer, it isn't going to be that big of an issue, because anybody who looks at their driver's license realizes that it has the date of issue on it, and that when they see the date of issue, they'll know the date of the effective date of the law, so they'll know whether or not the party is in violation or not. The second part of it is, I want to see this bill get out of this committee, and it's a House bill, and we don't have too much time to work on it.
That's it, Bill. Do you have some more comments?
Magic. Consistency, you know. We're trying to save lives. That's what this purpose is about. Then let's save the lives of a 16-year-old who gets his license on the 29th of February.
Yeah. Well, I don't feel guilty for something like that. I'm trying to make it through with saving a lot of lives. And if it's sort of a guilt complex on the bill, I'll kill the damn thing like that. Are there any other comments on it?
Mr. Chairman, I would support leaving the bill like it is. I think we're going to save lives. We have to have a law that we can administer, and I think it's going to be difficult to administer something to make it retroactive. I think we need a date when this goes into effect, when we have these timelines and all this sort of thing. So I would support leaving like it is.
Okay, now let's go on to the other amendments and discuss them. And then we can have the dash 3. We know we had Lamar. Okay, go ahead.
There's a couple of other things, Mr. Chair, on the dash 2 amendments. One is to clarify that the nighttime driving restriction begins at 12 midnight. The second is to apply the night driving restriction to the first year of the license only. The original bill had it, the night driving restriction for the entire time of the provisional license. And that would, the entire period would match existing curfew law. So that was a consideration, with whether you wanted to go one way or the other for the first year or for the 2 years for the nighttime driving restriction. Just some input from Senator Rowe's office that the 2 years was at 2 years was reasonable because it goes with the curfew.
Does anybody have any questions on that?
Then, Mr. Chair, we have some amendments to, of course, move it to 17 years of age the second year. Would make it the second year, so you know, we can look at that. It makes it again more complicated. I don't know how they're ever going to enforce this thing, all these different dates and ages, but that's what the dash 3s do. It makes another step, another graduation. So now we move from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. if you're 17. That's really all those amendments do. So it gives the first year, which is theoretically they get it at 16. We'd have to change the language, though, because it says the first year after issuance, and if he took his license out, let's see, when he was 17, then we'd have a conflict here. Because here it says it's 17 years age, and here, and this language says first year, so there's a little conflict there in the way that language would be written. I would suggest you not consider dash 3 because you're just muddling this up more.
I think you're right. I think that makes
it. The dash 3 amendment, Warren's representing Edwards and
I'm not here to muddle. There was a discussion about whether you make it one year or 2 years for the nighttime restriction. This is sort of a compromise. It says it's 2 years, but you get a graduated hour that second year. I looked in other states have that split. So 16 years from midnight to 5 and 17 to 18, you get another hour from 1 to 5.
This
committee's closed. Just give me an
amendment. I'm going to ask the amendment.
Bill, did you have a question before we go to the local?
I think we've gone, Representative Edwards raised an interesting point. The statistics, though, that actually 17-year-olds, there are more fatalities at midnight than by a huge margin. And that's the whole problem. I love this conversation about saving lives and doing all these wonderful things, but I don't, you know, if you start looking at statistics, it's not borne out that what we're doing is going to have a dramatic impact on saving teenagers. I mean, I'm probably going to vote against this thing because I think that what I'm willing to vote for is the requirement that you have a provisional license for a certain period of time and so many hours. I'll even vote for a 3-month restriction on one passenger, an additional 3 months. Beyond that, I mean, you know, we're playing games that look tough and sound good to teen drivers, and I don't know if there's any indication of doing anything effective. So I'm not willing to go there. And I got a 16-year-old. He's been driving for about 6 months, and I think he's as good a driver as his mother is. So.
That's on the record, Representative.
He had 80 miles an hour.
Can we have a motion from Representative Hill to move the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2440? Is there any further discussion? Janet, do you understand what we've done?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Additional thing in the Dash 2 amendment is to increase the period from 3 months to 6 months. I just want to make sure that we're aware of that when you make the motion. Increase the passenger restrictions that are in the original bill from 3 to 6 months, and the second, for your fewer passengers from 3 to 6 months as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Is there any opposition?
Oh, do you want the 100 hours instead of the 200?
100 hours is what the motion is. See that? Thank you. Thank you. All right, the two absent members excused. The Dash 2 amendments are approved. Did you want to go to the Dash? We have some other ones from Representative Hill. Yes, sir.
I move the Dash 1 amendment.
That's fine.
The Dash 1
amendment. Mr. Chair. Representative Hill moves the Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment. The holder of the license may not transport any person under 20 years of age in the bed of the pickup truck. Now, of course, it's one of the birthday is Representative Hill. Any discussion on this, Representative Hill?
Representative Hill didn't have the benefit of this discussion last session in this committee. We got onto this issue. Because I remember we had 5 different versions of how we were going to attack this pickup truck thing. Did it have a canopy? Did it have seats in it? Was it farm vehicle? And we had so many different versions. We tried to amend that bill, and finally we gave up because this gets into a can of worms here. I would not support this from the viewpoint of my farm people. A lot of people ride in the back of the pickup. Many of them put an old couch in the back, and they do sit down. And you know, we have to have certain racks on the side for OSHA. But we haul a lot of farm people in the back of pickups, and so. The way this is written, this will, you know, you got to get into details to really bog down in this right fast, so I wouldn't support this.
Okay, so there's a step up to the
do you have a dog back there? Does that make it okay, then?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't support hauling dogs or people in the back of a pickup, period. So I'd want to go to a more expansive bill that would never pass, so I'm not going to support this amendment.
Representative Hill, you have a very meritorious amendment, sir.
Mr. Chair, it's obviously I'm going to support, so I will withdraw my amendment.
We may have an opportunity. You ran by back country roads. Dead. Okay. We have that's all of our dashes.
Yes, Dash 4.
Dash 3 and Dash 4, okay. Right. Representative Edwards, did you want to talk about your two proposed?
Sure. Well, Dash 3, as I just described, provides a time for the nighttime restriction, one for from 16 to 17, from midnight to 5, and then from 17 to 18, from 1 until 5. And again, I looked at some other states that have split it that way. Obviously, the committee has to decide if they want to do it for 2 years, have that nighttime restriction as it's written in Dash 2, I think, or move it just to 17, so after 17, you're unrestricted at night.
Thank you. Any discussion on the Dash 3 amendments? Representative Leland?
Chairman, I mean, I don't like the nighttime restrictions, so we already have a curfew law that could be enforced if we wanted to. I understand there's some distinction about whether you can pull somebody over, but if a carload of kids is driving around, you can still run them in for curfew violation. In fact, you can have taken into custody. So I don't know that we need this, but if you feel obligated to put the driving restriction, I would think that we make the distinction of 17. At some point, you have to start saying, we're going to trust these kids to do the right thing, and they either drive or they don't. So.
Any further, Representative Ball?
Mr. Chair, that amendment doesn't fit in with our current language because it says for the first year after issuance of the license, you talk about 12 and midnight, and then absolutely conflict. If you put that language in, if the holder license is 17 years old, so we have a conflict between the first year if you take your license out when you're 17. So that's to be some rewriting. And
if the Representative Edwards is excited to talk about the -4 amendment for the next year.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. That conflict must have been drafted with LC. I don't know how that happened. Anyway, on the -4 is simply, as when I came in and just discussed the bill, the notion of trying to add seatbelts to the provisions, and what this is simply going to do is add Section 11 as a violation that begins you in a chain of ultimately you could lose your license if cited. It's a simple measure to add seatbelts to the provisions.
Discussion on the -4, Representative Hill.
Is this for the first offense or multiple offenses or
the first? It wouldn't throw you into a chain as Section 11 shows you. You'll get fined if you're caught anyway currently. And then if you get a second violation, then you have to get a.
But on the second violation, you get the more hanging or something. Mr. Chair, I move the -4.
Thank you, Representative Bill. Move the -4 amendments to House Bill 2440. Is there any discussion, Representative Wells?
Chair, I'm not going to support this. We basically passed a seatbelt law with, I think, about a $75 ticket. It isn't something you're going to lose your license over, and I think we're going too far if we're going to make that kind of an issue over safety belts. I wouldn't have ever supported the original law. I think that's something that's, I wear my seatbelt, but I think that's something that people make their own decision on. So I wouldn't support, unless I'm reading this incorrectly, I think that's a pretty heavy penalty.
Clarify what the first that would you wouldn't less than lose your license until it has to be your third violation of being cited for not having a seatbelt. So it puts you in the same chain that is in Section 11 that describes you'll get a warning letter, and then the second time you actually get a citation, you have to go to some sort of driver's training. It's just to try to hook in the need for seatbelts into provisions.
I will be voting no on that.
So Representative Hill moves the -4 amendments to House Bill 2440. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
Aye.
Representative Crockett.
Aye.
Representative Logan.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Walker.
Aye.
No. Aye. The -4 amendments are incorporated. The chair moves House Bill 2440 to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended. Any discussion? What's that? You want to make sure. Go ahead, Janet.
I just want to make sure people understand that because it's not printed anywhere in the bill, that the level of violation we're talking about for both passenger restrictions and the nighttime driving restrictions is operating without operating privileges, and it's a Class C traffic infraction, which is a fairly serious traffic infraction. So, because it's not printed in the bill.
Everybody understand that?
Could you say that again?
Yeah, it's a Class C operating without driving privileges would be a Class C traffic infraction.
Operating without driving privileges?
No, any of the violation of any of these provisions would be classified as operating without driving privileges because you're operating outside your restrictions.
So driving at night, driving with too many kids in the car, or driving without a seatbelt would all be C if you fit within the provisional license.
Not the seatbelt. Oh, so that affects their insurance pretty significantly for the Class C traffic insurance.
Well, Kelly, I see. Would you mind coming forward, Kelly Taylor, and giving us a little help here? Or
Mr. Chair, where is that written into the bill?
That's what I'm telling you. That it's not part of what you see in the bill, but it becomes operating. If you operate outside of restriction on your drive, you're operating without driving privilege.
Okay, briefly, Kelly, how are we doing?
Mr. Chair, Member of the Committee, Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation. What Jan is trying to tell you is if you drive somewhere in some vehicle where you don't have driving privileges, you're driving without valid driving privileges. It's in the very first part of Chapter 807. And if anybody, I mean, you know, if I were driving a commercial driving CDL type vehicle, if I didn't have a CDL, I'm driving without privileges. If I'm driving a bus, and so what you're doing with this license, you're saying in order to have valid privileges, these are the boundaries that you should be driving within. If you're driving outside of those boundaries, you're not driving on a valid driver's license. Not driving while suspended or anything like that. It's a Class C traffic infraction. A is the toughest, then B, then C, then D. So it's really on the lower half of the infraction. So a person could get a ticket. It's just driving without a valid license.
What is the penalty?
Pardon me?
What is the penalty?
Uniform bail schedule is $170. That's what would appear on your ticket for a Class C traffic.
Yeah, it wouldn't be the same for a person like me if I have a restriction on my driver's license that I have to wear these.
Yes.
If I'm not wearing these,
yeah.
I'm driving.
Right, driving outside the restrictions of your license, right. It's just the boundaries, right.
Okay, thank you. We understand the boundaries. Any further discussion? Will the clerk call the roll? The motion is move House Bill 2440 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation or whatever.
Representative
Hill. Aye. Representative Lehman. No. Representative Wilkin. Aye. Representative Taylor. Aye. Representative Walker. Aye. Representative Wells. Yes. Representative Wilkin. Aye. House Bill 2440 is amended. Goes to the floor. And I guess everybody else needs to. I'll carry it. Let's carry it every
day. No, I'll carry it. Representative Lehman would like to see it.
Okay, now back to the other agenda item. We have the public hearing. Not open the public hearing. Continue the invited testimony on House Bill 3344. We have one of the persons who was here the other day, and thank you for agreeing to come back. We appreciate it. And AAA was on the list, so we couldn't get to you. Thank you for this morning. Thank you for leading us out for running almost.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Craig Campbell. I represent AAA Oregon, Idaho. And I'm going to introduce myself first because I'm not going to talk first to you, so I figured I'd get it out of the way early.
I'm Larry Campbell, also represent AAA Oregon, Idaho. And I would, first before starting our testimony, like to commend Representative Lehman's courage. My colleague at this table, I remember well when he was 16 and driving, and I would never have stated on the record that he was a better driver than his mother, even though he might have been. Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to share our research, study, findings, and recommendations with you today. We have provided you with a black binder, which is in front of you. You can follow our testimony if you would like to do that. And I'd like to start by saying that this issue is about who's going to pay for Oregon's highways and how much they're going to pay. Don't be, by the way, misled by my friend Bob Russell's comments relative to the governor's letter. Mr. Russell stated the governor in a recent letter indicated that he would be pleased to sign House Bill 3344 if you pass the bill and put it on his desk. In that letter, the Oregon Trucking Association, the governor stated, and I quote, "The one matter connected to transportation upon which there is clear agreement between the Senate and House leadership and myself are the principles that apply to diesel tax. What is of consequences is whether revenue neutrality and cost responsibility is maintained between cars and trucks and between truck classes. Cost responsibility and revenue neutrality, the governor said, must be maintained now and into the future. This was also the goal stated, by the way, of the participants in the AOI discussions that were convened and which were participated in also along with AAA by OTA. Today we ask you not to consider moving this bill. If you have reason to believe that the results won't be cost responsible, if you have reason to believe that it will reduce the amount of revenue on our roads and highways, or that it will create large shifts of tax burdens between truck classes, or most importantly from a AAA standpoint, it will fail to meet parity between cars and trucks both now and into the future.
I'm going to talk to you a little bit about cost responsibility and how it applies to House Bill 3344. In short answer, House Bill 3344 is not cost responsible because the tax it creates doesn't reflect the use of the road or the wear and tear caused by the road user. The weight mile tax, the system we currently have in place, requires users to pay a rate for each mile based on the amount of damage that a given truck does based on the weight it travels. Heavier trucks pay a higher rate than lighter trucks because they cause more damage, and trucks that travel very few miles on the road pay only for the number of miles they travel. House Bill 3344 reduces the level of taxes on those trucks that use the roads and the most and cause the most damage, while increasing the tax on those who use the highways very little and cause less damage. House Bill 3344 would create a system where over 50% of the revenues are generated from registration fees, which are fixed. Registration fees have no connection to highway use. Whether you travel 1,000 miles or 100,000 miles, you pay the same registration fee. If you'll note the two charts that we have provided in the materials, the first chart shows that the current system was designed to tax based on the use of highways. Only a small portion of the tax revenue is raised by a fixed fee, about 5%. Under the system that you're looking at, those who do not use the roads pay very little. I'm sorry, under the current system, those who don't pay the system, don't use the system very much, pay very little, and those who use the roads extensively pay for their use. In short, it's a fair cost-responsible system. The system that's proposed under House Bill 3344 relies heavily on that fixed fee that I was talking about, 58%. This means that trucks will pay for the highways whether they use them or not. Those that use the roads very little will pay a substantial amount, while those who use the roads often will actually pay a lower cost per mile because they're able to spread the fixed cost over a larger number of miles. It doesn't reflect usage, it's not cost responsible, and it's not a fair way to apportion highway taxes between users. I also want to talk to you, since it's actually a related issue, about cost shifting between various classes of trucks. House Bill 3344 creates a pretty substantial tax shift from one truck of a class of trucks to another. The bill will shift the tax from large, long-haul, heavy interstate trucks onto small, short-haul, intrastate trucking companies. The first reason for this is because of the huge increase in registration fee. The tax burden is shifted from those companies who can spread the registration fee over a large number of miles, thus reducing their cost per mile. Short-haul trucking companies can't do this, and as a result, they're heavily impacted in their rate per mile. Under the existing system, if you look at the graph we've provided, trucks that do the same amount of damage currently pay almost the same amount per mile. The only difference is, if you notice the graph on the left-hand side, the three bars, those are all the same weight trucks. They do the same amount of damage per mile. The only difference between those three is that they travel different distances. The first one on the far left travels 30,000, the one in the middle travels 50,000, and the one on the right travels 80,000 miles. And that's the way it should be. If you do the same amount of damage whether you travel 1 mile or 100,000 miles, then you should pay the same amount per mile. Under House Bill 33, the high registration fee will require trucks that travel less miles to actually pay more per mile than those trucks who travel many miles, even though they do the same amount of damage to the road. Again, that's not fair, and that's not cost responsible. Interstate trucking companies who tend to run long-haul miles also get to prorate the registration fee so that the impact of actual dollars impact on their increase in registration fees has less effect. Interstate trucking companies must bear the full brunt of the more than the 11-fold increase. If all of your miles are run in Oregon, then you have to pay 100% of the registration fees. If you run only a percentage of your miles in Oregon, then you only have to pay that percentage of the registration fee equal to the percentage of miles you spend in Oregon. As an example, a trucking company that spends 10% of its miles in Oregon only has to pay 10% of the registration fee. Right now, for an 80,000-pound truck, that's about $32, because for a full registration fee, you pay about $320. Under the proposed system, which increases that registration fee by 11-fold, the 11-fold for an interstate truck in that case would be based on the $32, not the $320. Also, I want you to remember that diesel fuel taxes, although they do increase the taxes as your weight go up, are based on fuel efficiency, not wear and tear to the road. Under the weight mile tax system, the tax is based on wear and tear. So that those trucks who do more damage pay a proportionately higher rate. Their fuel efficiency is not proportionately less than that of lighter trucks, however. And if you look at the graph that's before you, you'll notice that the current system is the blue line, and the proposed system is the red line. For heavier trucks, under the current system, they would pay more. But with the proposal, House Bill 3344, their tax will go down to the red line. Whereas for the lighter trucks, their tax will have to go up to the red line. So what you're doing is you're shifting between heavier trucks and lighter trucks. I'd ask that in the back of this section you pull out a sheet that has an evaluation of a number of trucking companies that we've run for you. There have been comments by the back of section 3, right, the end of section 3. There have been comments by the bill proponents that much of the information that's been provided, including the stuff I've just provided you with, is anecdotal and it uses fictional examples. Today we're submitting specific examples that will provide you with a breakout of 18 different trucking companies representing a broad spectrum of winners and losers under the proposal. The biggest winners, as our analysis of the proposal has indicated, are large interstate trucking firms that run heavy trucks and long miles. Also, as anticipated, the largest increases in taxes are represented by trucking companies that operate exclusively in Oregon and that run trucks short numbers of miles. Even those companies who have trucks that are being extended special benefits under the bill, such as the low weight, low mileage exception, still can experience a tax increase because of the nature of their fleet. What I've done is I've provided an alias for each of the companies. I know that you members of the committee have the actual names of the companies that I've run, and at the end of the testimony I will provide Janet with copies of the actual paperwork analysis that I did on each of the companies. So if you wish a copy, you can look to her for that. But you'll note that for those companies that essentially are the larger interstate trucking companies that stretch from A to about F or G, that they end up having a tax break ranging from 53% for Company A. Company A, by the way, is somewhat of an anomaly. It's the second largest truck company operating in the state. Those that are more average of the top 300 that will benefit are companies B, C, and D. And then there's a variety of other companies that have been included that reflect interstate trucking. You'll note on that first chart that as you get the company I, J, K, and so forth, you don't really see the impact. And compared to the larger benefits experienced by the larger companies, on that graph you couldn't see the impact. So as a result, I've blown up made larger those trucking companies to show you what the difference is between what they would currently pay and what they would pay under the proposed tax. I should note in both of these graphs, the current tax is represented in blue. The OTA proposed tax is provided in red. To give you some perspective, let me move on to the next section. That is that the shift from heavy interstate hauling long-haul trucking onto smaller intrastate short-haul trucking is further exemplified by the presentation by Professors Hibbert and Negri that showed that the single weight class of 78 to 80,000 pound trucks, which pay 70% of the revenue into the system currently, will pay about $44 million less total. Now, it's expected that those truck classes above 80,000 pounds, which currently pay about a little over 17%, will also pay less. Not very much less, but a little bit less. What that means is that more than $44 million in revenues must be made up by that group of trucking companies that currently pay 12.5% of the revenue. Those are the trucks that weigh less than 78,000 pounds. With the special exemptions for low-weight, low-mileage vehicles, the $44 million will be shifted to an even smaller number of trucks because they, too, will have some break. They may end up paying a little more or a little less, but they certainly can't be looked to make up that $44 million in revenue. So by giving a tax break of $44 million to the 78 to 80,000-pound trucks, you're decreasing their tax burden by 32%, while increasing the overall tax burden on trucks under 78,000 by 173%. And there's no question that that represents a substantial tax shift between truck classes. and with few exceptions, this proposal is clearly designed to provide a major tax break to the 300 largest companies in Oregon, over half of which, as of 1996, were based in other states. Now, the question I would ask you is, if a company in your district came to you and asked for an over $2 million tax break, you'd have to ask yourself, how would it affect other people? And what is the bill doing for that one trucking company? But let's say that trucking company is not in your district. It's not even in your state. And that's what this proposal would do for that one trucking company. With that, I'm going to turn it over to the virus center. Well, that doesn't sound very formal.
Just don't say anything about mom's driving. We'll be all right. I'd like to shift to another subject that the governor also mentioned, and that's revenue neutrality. House Bill 44 is not revenue neutral. And let me talk about the shift of the $44 million for just one more moment. The shift is such a substantial amount tax burden begs the question, can the $44 million reduction be realized by increasing the tax burden on Oregon small trucking companies by the 173% that we've identified and that the chart that Craig just talked about demonstrates? It's not a question just of increasing the tax. It's a question of whether companies who run small numbers of trucks and operate in Oregon can make up the difference without going under. House Bill 3344 will have an even greater shortfall if the Dash 1 amendments are drafted, which will add two more special exceptions to the $15.3 million already in the bill, two which were not contemplated in the discussions of revenue neutrality by the AOI group. One of the two additions is a reduction in registration fee for the nine investor-owned utilities, one of which, under the OTA proposal, would have required them to pay $2,000 more in taxes, $200,000 more in taxes with the and with the special exemption, they now will be required to pay $2,000 less than their present tax obligation. The others in special registration fee exemptions for trucks used to assemble heavy equipment, and we don't have a figure on what kind of a buyout that would be. During the AOI process, everyone, including the OTA representatives, agreed that there would be a shortfall in 2002 and 2003 biennium in the amount of $26.3 million over those 2 years. To make up that shortfall, a further 4-cent diesel tax would need to be added to the bill. The shortfall in House Bill 3344 doesn't include monies lost by trucks registering at a lower weight in the future than they do currently. And many of them have been, it's been suggested to many of them that they have been registering at a too high a rate and that they should manage that registration. It also doesn't include monies lost from evasion, which we believe is substantial. While the bill attempts to reduce the risk of evasion by collecting the diesel tax direct, it does not address the method most readily available for truckers to evade. Those who evade under the current weight mile system, according to testimony from the truckers, can continue to evade in exactly the same manner for both diesel tax and registration fees. They merely misreport the number of miles they spend in other states. There are also other record methods of evasion that are exclusive to a diesel tax. Those are not adequately addressed in this bill, but it would take a great deal of time to explain the mechanics involved and the training and administrative costs in trying to prevent them. We're prepared to discuss these issues in more detail at the end of our presentation if the committee is so interested. The greatest cost responsibility and revenue neutrality imbalance created by House Bill 3344 is that it fails to raise the revenues required by any gas tax increase, present or future. It's in its current form, House Bill 2082 would raise the gas tax by 4 cents. Legislative revenue presented to you the information indicating that the trucker's share of the increase would be $44.1 million. The cost responsibility study indicates that 37.7% of the cost responsibility belongs to the trucks. Under the present system, when the gas tax is raised, truck taxes are raised accordingly. If that method is not continued, and it won't be under House Bill 3344, every time the gas tax is raised, the system becomes less cost responsible, and the cost of maintaining highways is shifted to a greater degree onto the motoring public. If the gas tax was raised under House Bill 2080, 2 and House Bill 3344 becomes law, the result would be an additional shortfall of $44.1 million, which would put cost responsibility even further out of bounds. Let's just take a look for a minute at what it would take to make up that amount of difference if the trucking companies were to agree in this bill to make sure that that was taken care of. There's a chart in the middle of page 11, which is the next page that we're on, that pretty well gives you a demonstration of the kind of change that would be necessary. In order to raise the required $44.1 million with the proposed method of taxation, it would require a fee that your registration fee to be increased to 14.25-fold for the 2001 biennium, assuming a 25-cent diesel tax, and a 15.5-fold increase in 2002 and 2003 biennium, and that's assuming a 29-cent diesel tax, which would be the 4 cents to make up the difference that's already identified as not being revenue neutral. Assuming that, you could keep the 11.25-fold registration fee increase currently in the bill and increase the diesel tax by 35 cents. You could keep the registration fee of 11.25-fold registration fee currently in the bill and make the increase by using diesel tax increases, which would be 35 cents in 2000, total 35 cents in 2001, by any amount, 42.4 cents total in 2002-2003. Or, obviously, you could have a combination of these options.
A clarification. Thank you. When you talk about 14.25-fold, I don't know what that means.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, our present rate,
right. Okay.
And in essence, the first proposal, as you recall, I think was 9.8.
Okay.
By the way, that's the one that is still on the trucking website. We watch that very closely because we want to know what, you know, is going on. And so if you happen to be a trucker and you're interested in finding out where you stand on this issue, don't look at that website. What they've recommended to meet this objective in the bill at 3344 is that we go up 11.2-fold.
Okay.
What it would take to match the gas tax that you've included in 2082, if you just did it with registration fee, would be these two figures.
Okay.
And as we say, you could do it either way. House Bill 3344 provides substantial tax reductions, as we've already said, to roughly 300 trucking companies based on 1996 information. These trucking companies at that point in time paid 46% of the truck taxes for the state highways. If you pass this bill, you'll be asking trucking companies, as we've already indicated a couple of times, to pay 12.8% of the taxes to pick up the entire shift. It's obvious that the 5,588 small Oregon-based intrastate trucking companies, those are folks who have less than three trucks, that operate exclusively in Oregon, are going to get hit extremely hard at this point. Since their interests are not represented by the lobby, why don't more of them stand up for themselves? Well, because they aren't even aware of what's happening. If you pass the bill, most of them will hear about it when they get nailed for the more than 11-fold increase in the registration fees. And we, by the way, for your benefit, have attached the forms that show the increase in registration fee by the weight class at both the 11.2 and also the 15.6. Or 1-6, so that you can look at the comparisons where if they met their revenue responsibility to match 2082, what the effect would be on trucks at each class level. Understand that the shift does not stop with House Bill 3344. It gets worse every time you increase gas taxes. Once you shift to the tax system established by House Bill 3344, the two options available to increase registration fee or diesel tax accordingly. In the former, you'll further impact short-haul trucks, and in the latter, you'll hurt medium and lightweight trucks. Often the trucks impacted fit both categories. We've already identified what the effect would be on the motoring public. In addition, if you increase diesel tax to the point where Oregon is out of balance with its neighbors, you will substantially damage another of Oregon's industries, the Oregon truck stop industry. And by the way, we were not asked to make that comment because, as many of you know, the Oregon truck stop industry has moved out of this field for good reason.
before we sum up, I want to do some clarification of previous testimony so that you get kind of another side of the view. There's testimony that was provided that indicated that the current bill would substantially reduce the level of administrative burden that's currently experienced by truckers. And for interstate trucks operating, by the way, I would suggest that you take a look at the graph that's on the next page, because what I'm talking about on this page is going to require you to look at that. For interstate trucks operating in Oregon, there will be very little change in the record keeping that is required. Most of the information that you must compile in order to file your weight mile tax, you also have to compile essentially the same information for registering your IFTA and IRP taxes. Now, there is one area of difference there, and that is that you don't need to keep track of your configuration changes if you eliminate the weight mile tax, and I'm going to go into that in just a moment. The next graph is the one that talks about configuration changes. The testimony gave you the indication that most trucking companies do a number of configuration changes as they operate. And if you look on the graph, you'll notice that 3/4 of all the trucks only register in one weight class, and that a little under 15% only register in two weight classes. And those are primarily trucks that operate in one direction with the trailer, drop the trailer, and come back with the cab as their two configurations. It makes sense because when they come back without the trailer, they get to pay a lower weight mile tax rate because they're weighing less, and it makes sense. The description of the high record-keeping burden from configuration changes are the exception rather than the norm. Less than 10% of the trucking companies that operate in the state have to keep track of more than two configuration changes. Now, to be honest, most of those folks do tend to be intrastate rather than interstate folks. There are a lot of interstate folks to drive from one side of the state to the other, and one configuration, that's all they do. So I'll say that for fairness. But they did indicate that administrative savings to trucking companies of $1,000 per company could be expected, and that would result in $36 million total for all trucking companies. Now, they didn't share with you how they arrived at that figure, and I can't figure out how they arrived at that figure. It's certainly not true for the Oregon small trucking companies, as you heard in your testimony. It's only a matter of spending a few minutes a month keeping track of your 1, 2, 3, or 4 trucks and writing down the miles that you've traveled with those trucks. If the $36 million has any credence, and I doubt it does, the benefit will go to the same folks who benefit from the $44 million tax break. If the issue, by the way, is merely reducing the administrative costs, then that's precisely what we should be talking about, not on eliminating a tax system that served us well for over 50 years and has been able to fairly apportion the cost of the highways amongst various truck classes. Another issue that was addressed by proponents of this bill was the impact of deregulation. And this is in many ways, I believe, the crux of the whole bill, but not the way that it's been explained to you. When regulated, a small number of very large trucking companies were able to control intrastate routes and effectively prevented small trucking companies from competing against them along those routes through PUC appeals. When deregulation occurred, those small trucking companies were allowed to compete in a free marketplace, and for the first time were able to compete against them along those routes that previously had been controlled by regulation. House Bill 3344 would effectively return the competitive advantage to the large interstate trucking companies, driving some of the small interstate trucking companies either out of business or out of areas where they're in direct competition with those large interstate trucking companies. When asked why, after 50 years of a weight mile tax, there's been such an effort in recent years to eliminate it, the answer given was deregulation. Now, it's a very, very complicated issue, and it would take me about 20 minutes or more to go over the presentation that I usually have given on that issue. So to spare you that, I provided you a 2-page document in your packet that explains motor carrier deregulation. Also, I've included in something I should have cited before. At the end of Section 5, you have a checklist showing the difference between what the record-keeping requirements are under IFTA, IRP, and the weight mile tax, and what an interstate truck would have to comply with under House Bill 3344, and what an intrastate truck would have to comply with under 3344. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and once again hand the gavel over to the gavel carrier.
Summation, why did we take the time to give you the Nevada Cost Responsibility Study a few weeks ago? Garth Dull indicated that the Nevada Motor Transport Association told the Nevada legislature in 1988 to get rid of the weight mile, and the proposal would be revenue neutral and wouldn't shift responsibility from one class of trucks to another. The 1994 study shows us that we maybe should take time to pause. 5 years after the Nevada Motor Transportation Bill passed, trucks as a whole, as of 1994, were paying $297 million less than their cost-responsible share of the highway. And if you'll turn to the back page in this section, you'll see that the responsibility, cost responsibility for all trucks, basic is 78.6, they're paying 78.6 of a responsibility that for basic should be 60.5, and that the heavies are paying 21.4%, or what should be 39.5. And that 39.5 responsibility is not too different than Oregon's 37.7. And the shortfall between those two is the $297,000 amount, or $297 million amount. Think of it as a glimpse of Oregon 5 years from now. And by the way, there's a present cost responsibility study being conducted in Nevada, and the indication we get is that what we're going to find in the 1999 study may even be worse than the 1994 study. It certainly makes sense that the president of the Nevada Motor Transportation Association, a supporter for big trucking, was willing to fly to Oregon to support House Bill 3344. And also why the former director of the Nevada Department of Transportation was so willing to come to oppose it. And by the way, for the record, Garth Dull does consult with the railroads. That rumor has been spread, but was not here to represent them. Basically, he was representing his knowledge at the time he was the head of the department. And we certainly don't represent the railroads, and I want to underline that. To our knowledge, the railroads aren't even involved in this discussion in Oregon. The ill-founded rumor that we do is neither helpful nor appropriate. House Bill 3344 is not cost-responsible. It creates a severe shift onto Oregon's small trucking business, as we've said so many times in our testimony. It doesn't raise as much money as the current system. It doesn't make sense to increase the gas tax 4 or 6 cents and not get anything out of it. I would urge you to resist promises that we'll take care of that in the future. This bill is merely an attempt to meet a national goal to eliminate the weight mile tax. There's been a good deal, by the way, of committee time spent on AOI survey that was mailed to approximately 3,000 Oregon companies and which received a response from approximately 400. Mark Nelson made a special point of identifying that the AOI survey was not scientific and in effect merely provided the perception of truckers' positions on the OTA proposal based on winners, losers, and those who expect no change. He made a special point saying that the winners favored the proposals, the losers opposed it, and those who were not affected to the greatest degree also supported the proposal when they responded. What Mark didn't know is that during the survey, the OTA sent two communications, which you'll find in Section 7 of this report, two communications urging their members to respond to the survey by indicating that they support the OTA proposal. Not only was it not scientific, but it was nudged. AAA also sent out a survey, and that also, the survey is under Section 7 when we have a chance or if you'd like to review it. We specifically waited until 10 days after the AOI survey deadline, and so we didn't want to skew the results of their efforts. The survey we at AAA sent out was to operators of trucks weighing between 26,000 pounds and 58,000 pounds. Of course, this also was not a scientific poll. We provided a form that would enable them to figure their own results to determine if they'd be winners or losers. Here are the responses. I found it was very effective if you hold up a big batch of papers. The interesting thing about these responses is that of the number, 26 of the result shows that 12, 8% were undecided. I get rid of those. And then we found that 22 or 15% said that they would pay less under this proposal. The interesting thing was when we got to looking at the 112 returns that said that they would pay more. And remember now, these are all trucks below the 78,000 or 80,000 class. I just want to read a couple of comments because it was interesting. People added their comments to some of these. And by the way, the folks who said, hey, AAA told us about this Monday, and that's the reason we're here to testify. Well, it was the result of receiving this pull that was mailed to the 26,000 pound trucks, the 56,000 to 58,000 pound trucks. Listen to these comments of people who did not have an opportunity to testify in front of you. This one, as a female owner-operator, this whole business is challenging about every aspect. As you are aware, the cost of operation is almost too much already. DEC licensing, registration, fuel service costs, repairs, etc. It is presently the cost is outrageous. $1,000 a year added to my present expense, this would definitely take food out of my mouth. It will cripple my future as an operator in the business. If this is increased $1,000 a year added, if this increase of $1,000 a year is added to my present expenses, it would definitely take bread out of my mouth. Number two, my one truck tractor is used only to transport my backhoe. I do this for safety reasons. If this measure passes, it will force me to tow my backhoe with a pickup, which I feel would be very unsafe. Next one, I think the proposal is hogwash and I won't support it. Next one, this will be more than double what I'm paying now. We're strongly against this proposal. Under the proposed taxes, the next one, I could not afford to keep my customers on and on and on. People are starting to wake up and understand that they're going to be affected by this particular bill. I also would suggest that there was another poll taken in 1997, and this one was scientific, and this is the one I think is most important for you to consider. I believe the findings are quite relevant. By a 75 to 18% margin, voters told us that they would prefer that commercial trucks pay taxes based on wear and tear a truck causes to the road and highway system. And then we asked another question in the poll. We said, but the commercial trucking industry say they cannot afford to continue to pay the current amount of road taxes due to competition and deregulation of the trucking industry. And the answer we found, we asked knowing this would favor the reducing, we asked knowing this, would you favor or oppose reducing commercial truck taxes from the current rate? Given this argument, 21% they would favor reducing commercial truck taxes, while 66% said they would oppose such a move, 12% undecided. However, when we asked the respondents if they would still favor reducing a commercial trucking tax, if they knew it would reduce the amount of money available to Oregon for roads and highway repair, maintenance, and construction, only 12% of those polled said they would still favor reducing commercial trucking taxes. Given that information, 73% said they would oppose such a move, and 15% went into the undecided column. The Oregon motoring public, and I guess that's who we represent in AAA, does not, for good reason, agree with the effect that will be created by House Bill 3344. If this bill passes into law, it will have an effect. Small trucking folks will find out when they pay their registration fees, and motorists will discover that they're paying increased taxes to subsidize large trucking companies, and you're the ones that are going to call and ask about it. Don't pass a bad bill for the wrong reason. We strongly urge a no vote on 3344 for the reasons we've shared, and we're prepared to answer questions.
Do you have any questions?
Larry, when you talked about the $44 million of inequity from the cost shift in between classes of trucks, if that were not the case, for whatever reason, then didn't you feel that the proposal is revenue neutral?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, as we identified, even the AOI meetings identified a shortfall of $26 million for 2002, that time period. So the answer is no, it would not be revenue neutral. We're not even sure that $44 million is a large enough amount, but basically what we've done with the figures we've given you is if they can't be substantiated either by our research or the research folks like Hibbert, we're not using them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, there is one thing that's confusing about our testimony in that we have two different $44 million businesses. One is a shift from those trucks who weigh 78 to 80,000 pounds onto other trucking classes, and the other is the shortfall in cost-responsible contributions for trucks if you raise the diesel tax, or the gas tax, I mean. It's unfortunate that those numbers happen to be almost identical, but they are two different numbers.
access register.
When you you imply, or you say in your testimony here about the AOI survey, that the OTA had sent out two communications afterwards, and you imply that, that they skewed the respondents by those communications, but essentially didn't you do the same thing with your poll by only, by in two areas that I can see, by only asking truck weights between 26,000 and 58,000, and then also using language in your survey that says proposed tax scheme. Now, I would never accuse you of sounding like Vice President Gore, but I vividly remember his debate with Jack Kemp.
That's from personal security. I mean, now it's just not called for yet.
The implication there is very clear. I'd like to respond to that by saying that we didn't attempt to impugn the truckers' efforts. What we did want to identify is that Mr. Nelson pointed out that 25% of the people wouldn't be affected, and to help their case said, and these folks are poor, even though they wouldn't be affected. And what we're saying is that the two communications that they sent out, I'd be happy to read them for you if you like. Not necessary. Basically would have had an influence on it. Did we skew it by inviting folks from 26,000 to 58,000 in? The answer is absolutely yes, because we were looking for people who were adversely affected by this bill, and we figured that the 26,000 to 58,000 category was definitely affected, and there was no question when we got the responses back, we had picked the right category. Now, it would probably have been even better if we could have sent 36,000 of these out, because that's about the number of trucking companies we have in Oregon, and found out where each one of them stood. We also might find an opportunity to wake up some folks who haven't recognized what the potential disaster is that's going to face them when they get their bill for their registration fee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kraut, the other thing I would say is that the AOI poll was intended to be an objective poll that just got people's perceptions. It wasn't intended to get people to respond. As a result, we specifically waited 10 days until after the deadline before we sent our poll out. Our poll, on the other hand, was specifically designed to let certain people know that they were at risk of having their taxes increased without them knowing. So the intention of our poll was quite different from that of the AOI poll.
Yeah, sure. Mr. Chair,
it's very good.
When you talk in your summation, your ending paragraph talks about the motoring public, if this bill is passed, will eventually realize that there's inequity that's occurring from your perspective. And it says that they're going to call us. If we're passing a gas tax increase, if that happens in this body, and this bill passes, how's the motoring public going to know any different? Who's going to tell them? And AAA only has so many members, and you can send it out in your newsletter, but how are they going to know that trucking companies are not picking up their fair share?
Well, I think that the information in Nevada is very clear, and if you take a look at what's happened in Nevada, the people in Nevada are certainly learning about the shift, and it is a shift auto motoring public. And by the way, if we were just to tell our members, Representative Krupp, we're talking about 600,000 members in Oregon and Idaho, and that's a substantial number. Over 500,000 of those are in Oregon. And if you look at 500,000 AAA members in a community of, what, a little over 3 million population, that's a pretty good-sized portion of the population.
It is. I stand corrected, sir.
No.
One last question, Mr. Chair, and then I'll shut up. Do you believe that there can be substantive evasion recapturing in the OTA proposal that we may be losing now by their method of collecting a diesel tax at the rack as opposed to at the pump?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I think that if Oregon currently had a diesel system that taxed at the pump and you moved to the rack, you certainly would see that. But when you're moving from a weight mile tax to a diesel tax, then you're comparing apples and oranges. I think it would be very foolish for the state to adopt a diesel tax that didn't tax at the rack because of the experience that other states have seen. I mean, clearly with California reporting that I believe they said that they recaptured 30% additional revenue from moving to the rack, that showed you that there was substantial revenue loss due to evasion in California before they made that move. What it doesn't say is how much more there still is there present.
Thank you.
Secretary Hill, then Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would a better terminology for these polls be questionnaires rather than polls?
I think we identify the first two Representative Hill as surveys, and the third one is a poll. Scientific poll, Hibbert's poll.
I just wanted to, I know you don't want to get into the additional opportunity for evasion taxing diesel, but is it beyond what we've had presented to us about Caterpillar fuel and other kinds of diesel fuel being dyed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, that is certainly part of it. Import-export schemes are certainly part of it. There are some things you can do, as in Washington, and I believe this bill tries to attempt, is that if you have a state or a company that imports and exports, that you require them to register in both states, that can take care of one kind of import-export evasion to some extent. You still have to be fairly strong in watching it. What it doesn't do is it doesn't protect against evasions caused by import of export of fuels that's actually diesel fuel that's reported as dyed fuel. In order to get to that, you have to do inspections, and it's not a situation where you can just have an inspector jump up on the top of the truck, open it up, and test the fuel. Because you don't know what's in the tank when they're reported as dyed, you have to go through certain training precautions to make sure that they aren't getting themselves into a situation with a toxic chemical that they don't know how to handle. So there's certainly a good deal of training that's required there. The other problem with trying to stop that kind of evasion is you can't really do it with paperwork. You have to do it without in the field inspections, and that results in administrative costs.
Sure, thank you. One of the things that just struck me, and it hasn't changed a bit, I guess, is that we're stuck with a policy decision between a very cost-accountable system that is also very expensive to collect, and that's kind of the policy discussion we're having. Has any thought been given to the concept of taking some of that cost of collection, you know, anywhere from $8 to $14 million, and taking that out of what the truckers have to pay and somehow spreading it over the entire system other than just taking it out of their share?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lehman, one of the things that we think is absolutely necessary is to identify a better system of handling the reporting for the existing tax system. And there are technical improvements being made. I was interested in a bill that's been submitted to the legislature, which would eliminate the ability of the legislature to require transponders and global positioning on trucks, which might be a very definite way of handling it. We've been in contact, and we're expecting contact back shortly from folks who are using global positioning now for their trucking. A lot of the costs that are associated with this can be reduced. A lot of your costs for the Department of Transportation are people who are going out and auditing to make sure that we're paid the right amount of money. And as Craig says, just by putting a diesel tax in doesn't eliminate all of the need for auditing or for tracking.
I guess my question to be more specific is that assuming that there is a cost out there above a fuel tax to collect the weight mile tax, is there a policy consideration to say that's a tax we ought to all, that's a cost we ought to all bear? Because in effect what we're doing is we're saying this is a fairer system between cars and trucks. You could do it cheaper for trucks, but let's pass that cost on to the entire motoring public rather than just the trucks because they have a better system if they wanted to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, it causes some problems when you're talking about maintaining cost responsibility and doing something like that. Currently, the way cost responsibility is supposed to work is that the cost that a given user puts on the system, they should pay for. And part of that, in this instance, is the cost of the motor carrier division goes to trucks, just like DMV, for the most part, goes to cars. And so if I understand you correctly, you're talking about essentially taking the cost of administrating the weight mile tax in the motor carrier division and requiring all users to pay for that. Is that what you're suggesting or asking about?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, other than the fact that that would change the way we currently do cost responsibility, I don't know how AAA would respond to that. I wish I could tell you right up front, but I can't.
Mr. Chairman, I will make one comment, and that is we said from day one, if the legislature wants to give the trucking industry a tax reduction in the tax rate, we have no opposition to that, as long as it doesn't adversely affect the method that we have presently of identifying the tax responsibility in the state. So,
Mr. Lowe?
Sure. One other question that has come up, and I guess it's an argument that I give the least weight to, is that there is a system has created a terrible imbalance between trucking costs in Oregon and trucking costs in other states. Is there any evidence that you've seen out there that, in fact, we're at some kind of disadvantage, either in the lack of availability of shipping into the state or a higher cost for shipping in this state than other states, that there's a competitive disadvantage?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, aside from the testimony that I heard about what has happened to the Christmas tree producers or growers, I have not heard that kind of thing before. I know that there's an argument out there, but you have to understand in Oregon, a truck, whether it comes from another state or is a different color or is it doesn't matter what they carry. If they're at a given weight, they pay the same cost per mile. So it's hard for me to believe that you would be at a competitive disadvantage if a truck from California pays that cost per mile in Oregon, just like an Oregon truck pays that cost per mile. I understand that there's an argument that, well, those folks who are operating in California have a lower overall cost, if they can reduce their cost in Oregon and undercut competition in Oregon. I can't see how you could do that without raising your costs in California to counter that. But I am by no means an expert on interstate competition between trucking companies, so I'm a little loath to go too far down that path.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lehman, we did a complete study as to the effect of, because one of the comments that was made by the trucking industry is that we were number one in the nation on the cost, and what we found is that we were number four in the nation on 1.4% of our trucks. We would be glad to provide that study to you folks for your review.
Mr. Chair, there's actually a new study that's come out just recently. It's still in draft form, and I haven't been able to do an analysis on that. But to identify that Oregon has the highest tax rate, that would be true for one class of trucks traveling one certain number of miles, which is not by any stretch of the imagination the average truck. And in fact, you could argue that Oregon has the highest taxes, so Oregon has the 36th highest taxes, depending upon the truck you chose and the number of miles it traveled. So it's a little dangerous to look to that.
I know that particularly Craig has been at the table for a long time on the cost, the revenue neutrality, and then I think that everybody would agree that the numbers that have come together here are as close as anybody's ever come to getting some kind of neutrality. The thing that I'm concerned about, and I don't know if you have any opinion on this, is that I would have a feeling that when you make this kind of shift in systems, there's going to be a change in registrations and uses of vehicles out there. And do you have some kind of sense of what will happen if we implement this system tomorrow? Will that have an impact on revenues?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Lehman, when we were discussing the AOI process, part of the discussion that allowed us to come to revenue neutrality was the assumption that everyone who currently registers a truck in Oregon today would continue to register that truck in at the same rate. The problem was is that in that room we had no way of knowing what the impact would be. We knew that there would be some impact, but what it would be, we don't know. Unfortunately, there's been no other state that's done more than a threefold increase in registration fees. 11-fold increase is certainly going to have some impact on the market. Some trucking companies that I've talked to, it's actually been suggested to them that they register their trucks at lower weights and maybe go to trip permits where possible. Some of those trucking companies obviously can't do that, but at least you know that the idea is out there that you may be able to save some money by registering the lower weight. If that happens, that means that we're going to face another revenue shortfall because those folks won't be paying their current levels. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along those lines, I have two questions. But along those lines, and this has been one of my great concerns with this proposal, is some of the folks who drive lower mileage are going to face substantial increased fees
Is there some room there? I know you've also discussed, well, what happens if you don't quite increase those fees to that level, then you have to raise the fuel tax even higher. What ultimate effect, if they chose that route, what ultimate effect would raising the diesel tax each higher have in Oregon as a whole? Obviously, it's going to have impact on the truck stop operators. There's no question about it. How will that disadvantage Oregon as a whole in terms of us making this public policy decision?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, if you increase the diesel tax, aside from whatever it might have an impact on, not just on the trucking industry, but those who deal in diesel fuel, it'll have probably two impacts. One is that it will further, again, shift onto lighter and medium trucks who currently pay less under a weight mile tax than they would under the overall proposal. That one graph that showed how it shifts from heavy to lighter. That would be one impact. The other problem is if the fuel is being collected in other states, which is likely to happen if you have too high diesel fuel tax compared to other states, then Oregon has to wait to get its money back from IFTA. Now, that may not be a substantial impact, but depending upon how much you depend upon a diesel tax and how long you have to wait for that tax to be returned to the state, then you're going to have a lag time in your revenues, and that's going to cause you some problems.
Okay. Sure. One more. Along the lines of the question that Representative Lehman had in terms of, do you believe the OTA's assertion that the fact that we have this system of weight mile collection does keep some trucking firms out of this state in terms of doing business, and does that then not offer us, me as an individual who ships his product by truck primarily, does that not hurt me as a businessman by not having increased competition, which may lower my shipping costs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, again, I don't pretend to be an expert in the reasons that trucks use in order to determine when they do or don't operate in the state. But I can tell you that the total percentage of costs for operating a truck that's based on administration is very, very low. The information that's collected in order to file your weight mile tax report, they're already collecting now. The likely folks who would be impacted in deciding whether they would come to the state of Oregon or not are obviously interstate trucks that are based in other states. And they're large enough, probably, so that the administrative cost is not going to be a problem for them. In fact, you can probably hire somebody else to do your weight mile tax reports. So I don't believe that the weight mile tax in and of itself is keeping trucks from operating in the state of Oregon. I would imagine there may be some other things that I'm not aware of, but I don't think that complying with a weight mile tax is the first thing that comes to their mind when they decide whether or not they can operate in the state.
Thank you.
Especially since you have to operate in Idaho with a weight mile tax as well.
Representative Hill?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess on that vein there, in terms of earlier testimony by the Truck Association indicated that the main impetus for this change was the overly burdensome nature of the weight mile tax. Then we sort of heard testimony that, well, wasn't really that burdensome. So I'm trying to understand now, I guess, the spreads of trucking companies aren't coming to Oregon, and therefore Oregon businesses' trucking costs are higher because there isn't competition, there isn't added competition. How do we sort through this in terms of...
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, you have to understand those folks who are really feeling a high burden from administration are likely to be those trucks that do a large number of configuration changes, and there's no question about that. That's where a large amount of administration comes from. Most small trucking companies especially, they don't do a lot of configuration changes, and if they do, it's not that difficult to keep track of it. Where your problem comes in is when you have a very large fleet and you're keeping track of a lot of different sets of information, and for them it will be more burdensome. There's no question. As to whether or not that is going to impact them coming into the state, I, or not, I don't know. The trucking fleets that I look at, a number of them that travel interstate are based in Oregon, do a number of configuration changes, and they're still operating in the state. I would imagine that the reason why somebody would operate in the state is going to be dependent more upon whether or not there's freight here for them to carry, rather than whether or not they'll have a higher administrative cost.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add to that, if you look at the chart in Section 5 that identifies the administrative responsibilities of the trucks, you'll find that IRP and IFTA make up a good number of those. And even if you look at interstate, House Bill 3344 still requires some things that IRP and IFTA don't require. So we're not saying that it isn't burdensome. It may very well be burdensome. What we're saying is that a good deal of it is still required because you have to meet the requirements of reporting under IRP and IFTA. The place where it looks like the greatest savings would be under 3344 is with intrastate trucks, not interstate trucks. And if you look at the makeup of the reporting requirement under intrastate trucks, you'd see where there's a number of things that are reduced as a result of reporting there. But what we're basically saying is a lot of those intrastate trucks are small trucking companies, and you heard from some of those on Monday regarding the amount of time it takes for them to do their reporting. Just kind of in a jocular way to respond to, are we having trouble getting trucking companies to come into Oregon, interstate trucking companies? If you've driven I-5 recently, you can answer that question for yourself, I think.
Sort of in terms, I don't know what section it is, in terms of what section did you have the direction of the company? Indicate how much company they're going.
Oh, the individual trucking company analysis, that's in Section 3.
So, to get down to brass tacks here, the real pitch for 3344 probably is not the savings that are going to be generated through the elimination of weight mile, but it may be driven more by the fact that the largest companies on this list is going to save $2 million a year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, although the $2 million a year is an anomaly, I think it's more the tax savings than it is the administrative savings. Certainly.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for getting the
time we're hearing on Council 3344. For the benefit of the committee, we need a fiscal, I was just informed, but also we need to find some technical way. We passed House Bill 2440 out, and we didn't have a fiscal in, so we need to hold that.
Mr. Chair, if there's any surprises in the fiscal, but you can pass it out. The committee understood that they were passing it out without a fiscal.
Okay, good. What we would like to do for the benefit of the committee is have a work session Friday morning on the bill. We'll start at 8 o'clock punctually. We have a lot of information to go over. We'll have the fiscal from revenue then at that time. And hopefully that'll be the first item on our agenda. We'll start at 8 o'clock. Representative Lehman has to leave at 9, so I hope we can get everything done within an hour. You have 2 days to get all your questions asked for everybody you want to ask, including Representative Walker and then Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate you holding off on this until Friday morning. There's been a lot of evidence and testimony presented. I feel a lot like one of the judges that I work for, and I want to take some time and really go through the analysis and come to a conclusion that I think is going to be the correct one for me individually and the voters of Oregon. So I really appreciate that, and if I have any questions for those of you who out there who have testified, I will call you. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Representative Crummel asking today, too, that he will be inside. The Representative Bill and then Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we anticipating amendments to this, or are they going to be distributed to us prior to the meeting?
There will be no amendments you don't already have. I believe we have a dash. We can discuss those now. That might be a good opportunity. The dash 1-2 amendments. There will be no dash 3 amendments, period. So we can discuss these now if you'd like to. That might be a good opportunity to take a few moments. And the dash 3s, if you might
like
to discuss those. Who's going to have the dash 3s?
Mr. Chair, you have been all given the dash 1 amendments fairly early on. Those are the ones that fill in the blanks, and this is the matrix that shows what those amendments do. and state. We also have dash two amendments to Representative Lehman or from the And let me know if you need an additional copy of the dash one amendments you make.
Would the committee like to discuss them for a few moments here? We have moved the adjourn no later than 10 o'clock for sure, but we don't have sessions on 10:30.
So, briefly, Mr. Chair, the dash one simply just fill in the blanks. And there's no other substantive changes?
No, there are substantive changes in the dash one amendment.
Okay, I've seen the comparison chart now. Found it.
Mr. Chair, the changes on the first page of the matrix covers what the diesel tax collection provisions, because we do not currently collect diesel tax for this size truck, and this is also changing the collection of diesel to the supplier or the rack. And those are the changes that are necessary to do that, including setting up a guide fuel program that the state, the federal government has a guide fuel enforcement program, but the state does not currently have one. So those are the provisions necessary. The changes are not clarify some of those provisions, and those changes were made at the request of some from the petroleum industry, some from the Department of Transportation. The next provisions are setting up licensing for the people that will be paying the tax or obtaining fuel without payment of the tax. Licensing provisions, and the changes in the dash one amendments are not are listed in the right column, but they are, I don't think any of those are controversial.
If you have any questions as we're moving through, please ask them now, because we're going to vote them up or down, right, and we're not going to discuss it too much either. Ms. Layman?
Sure, two things. I think the dash two amendments are a response to a question made that revenue neutrality, the second biennium, will just add 4 cents to the fuel tax to extend the neutrality out. Yeah, one other question I had is, are we going to get an opportunity to hear from Mr. Russell? As, I mean, there's been a lot of stuff that's come in since he testified. Is he going to get an opportunity to come back and try to update where we are or correct some of the damage that's been done? Or,
well, I don't think there's been any damage done, but we will be in a work session, and that will be the opportunity for us to call people forward and discuss. I sure don't want to get into a he said, she said, and we get into a get an argument, but if you have specific questions about specific issues, of course, that's what the work session is about. They'll be invited by the members, whoever has a question. We're not going to get in debate. Debate's over. Representative Hill?
Will we have a revenue statement before this
semester? No, we're waiting until Friday to get the
statement.
Yes, that's just to say the revenue statement.
Okay, those are two different
things.
Well, both. Okay.
Here's
Mr. Chair, on the second page of the matrix, it's talking about the refunds that will be available for the diesel tax, and the ones that were in the original bill are up to 45% of the tax paid is available as a refund for vehicles like concrete mixers and self-loading log trucks that use power takeoff units that is powered by the diesel, but not used. The diesel is not used for road purposes. Up to 15% of the tax paid for log trucks, an additional amount if they can verify that that's more mileage was spent off-road than that would cover. In the amendments, the additional refunds, the dash one amendments are to investor-owned utilities for 70% of the tax paid, and for there's a small number of trucks that operate ancillary equipment, and they can get a full refund of the tax paid under the dash one amendments. And I think Bob can cover what those are when he comes up later. There is, at the end of the bill, a number of sections that deal with adjustment of the diesel tax if revenue from the diesel tax does not come in as projected. There are changes in the dash one amendments to those adjustment provisions that are covered in the column, so that if the revenue comes in more than 5% over an estimated amount, there's a 10% reduction in the tax. If it comes in 5% less than revenues projected, there's a 10% increase in the tax. And those adjustments are made at 6 months intervals. And finally, the main changes in the bill are the registration fees. The amounts were blank in the original bill, and the Dash 1 amendments fill in those rates for both for the fixed fee and the variable fee. The fixed fee is 2 times the current fee, and the variable fee is 9.2 times the current fee, registration fee at all levels, for a total of 11.25 times the registration fee. The other blank that's filled in is that concrete mixers, log trucks, and dump trucks will only pay a variable fee of $500. They will not pay the full variable fee. And that trucks owned by investor-owned utilities in the Dash 1 amendments will pay the fixed fee only and will not pay any of the variable fee. Mr. Chair, those are the changes in the Dash 1 amendments. The bill does take effect January 1st in the year 2000 for elimination of the tax and imposition of the BCA.
Co-op, in terms of, I don't know if today's the day pay.
Mr. Chair, there's been quite a bit of discussion between the industry and rural electric co-ops as to whether they would want to come under the similar amendment to the investor-owned utilities. They have a similar situation, but possibly smaller trucks that run through the miles that may come in under one of the brakes already. So they're trying to figure that out at the current time.
Any further discussion? Well, thank you all very much. I'd like to thank both sides for being very professional. They're both very good presentations. We thank you very much. It makes our job more difficult to have two good presentations. We will meet Friday morning for the benefit of the committee. We have many, 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 many more bills to hear. We'll try to have a list for you Friday or Monday for sure, the bills that are still alive. We saved 12 more of them this morning. I don't know how much life they've got, but we saved them. And we'll meet 8 o'clock. Sure appreciate you being on time, and then we'll start off on this and do whatever time you have. We're set to close at 3:44. Hopefully the discussion will be up to the adjourned.